Welcome to Worlds Apart. Until a few weeks ago, the conflict in Ukraine was treated in Western media as a major threat to the rules-based order, and one that is most likely to decide the outcome of a battle between the forces of democratic good and autocratic evil. But the eruption of violence in the Middle East has manifested a totally new order of brutality, which has made it so much more difficult, even for the self-assured West, to take sides or offer easy solutions. What does this crisis mean for the international system? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Dmitry Suslov, Deputy Director of the Center for Comprehensive European and International Studies at the Higher School of Economics in Moscow. Dmitry, it's good to see you again. Thank you very much for your time.
Hello, Oksana. Nice to meet you. Nice to see you. Always pleasure. Thank you.
Now, let me first ask you, not as a scholar, but as a colleague of mine, as a media professional, and for our audience, I want to mention that Dmitry is also hosting a geopolitical show called Great Game on one of Russia's biggest channels. And I think as media professionals, we have just witnessed a major change in the in how global media currents flow, because the reality in Gaza was so unexpected and so shocking that I think it caught many Western media off guard, and they were put into a situation when they actually have to report on that reality rather than trying to preemptively shape it or frame it. So in that case, very rare case, reality seems to be trumping perceptions. What does it mean in terms of the global informational war? Because whether we like it or not, there is a battle of narratives going on.
Well, Oksana, I think that it is a very significant development in the Western media in several sense. First, of course, the Western media was caught off guard because we all remember 3 weeks ago, Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor of the United States, try to convince everyone that the Middle East was in the most peaceful position within decades, right? And the Western media seemed to believe in it. They deliberately tried to ignore the question of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and put it kind of beyond the brackets, simply forget about it and focus on different things. Second point, I think that what's going on in Gaza now is putting the Western media in a very awkward position. And the West is basically losing the global information war because Israel unquestionably is a part and parcel of the West. But today, after experiencing this shocking attack, terrorist attack, Israel in its turn is conducting atrocities of such a scale that you can't really present it or shape the narrative of a justified and proportionate use of force and justified self-defense. You can't do it. And this really puts the media in a very awkward position. They have to report on what's going on instead of trying to shape the narrative of Israel being on the good side of history.
I wonder, how do you understand the Netanyahu's government seeming resolve to take Gaza by force? Because for all his firebrand rhetoric, Benjamin Netanyahu is known as a highly calculating politician. He cannot be ignorant of all the possible repercussions of such a move, military, civilian, economic, international. And by proceeding with a military operation, Israel would be destroying the very status quo that it itself helped to create and maintain. Why take such a huge risk?
Well, first, I think Netanyahu needs it to prolong his political existence, you know, because people already ask questions how it all could happen. People put the blame on Netanyahu and his government personally, claiming quite rightly that certain indicators were ignored at the level of political leadership, and they actually made this situation possible, so they bear the political responsibility. In order to avoid paying the price for that, I think Netanyahu wants to dissolve the current conflict in a bigger conflict, which he is now trying to deliberately create. The bigger conflict, I think, is a conflict with Iran. And what we are seeing, and I think this is of immense importance, Netanyahu is trying to shift the narrative, to completely shift the narrative, claiming that what is going on has nothing to do with the Palestinian and Israeli conflict per se. The real reason for the crisis is Iran.
Dmitry, can I ask you here something? Because I think this is a very interesting analysis. To some extent, having a war with Iran, which is still a state actor, therefore it's far more responsible and in some ways more predictable, would suit Israel's current situation. Because on the one hand, you don't have to invade Gaza as they have been suggesting or have been talking about. But on the other hand, it allows them to have a war, but a sort of an easier war. Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, it's not necessarily an easier war. That is certainly a bigger war, a war on several fronts, because it would definitely involve Hezbollah and Lebanon in general. It would also inevitably involve the United States. And I think Netanyahu's calculus is that if there is such an escalation of the war from just a pure local conflict in Gaza to a broader conflict, at least with all the Iranian proxies, and at maximum with Iran itself, the United States would have to engage. And that would, completely switch everyone's attention from why actually the attack from Gaza.
Essentially, what you're talking about is a proxy war, but a proxy war that will be fought rather than by Israel, by the United States. It's the same proxy
Absolutely.
Tactic, but shifting the burden onto the bigger actor.
And with the help of the United States, Netanyahu hopes to prevail in this broader conflict with Iran, and eventually turn out as a winner in this grand confrontation against Iran, not meaning the destruction of Iran, of course, but reducing the Iranian outreach and influence on the neighboring regions for Israel. And look, I think it is very significant, because Israel has long positioned Iran, not Palestinians, not Arabs, but Iran, as the major existential threat for itself. So prevailing over this existential threat would make Netanyahu a winner, one of the biggest winners in the Israeli history, instead of a loser who, because of domestic political struggles and frictions, actually made this attack by Hamas possible. I think this explains his current behavior.
I do want to ask you about the Israeli-Palestinian problem, which existed for so many decades that I think we all have become somewhat detached and desensitized to what is actually happening on the ground. And what is happening on the ground is that it's essentially a huge human pressure cooker in Gaza that's been generating rage and resistance for three generations, and perhaps will continue to do so for many more. And it's like a real life laboratory for turning humans into human bombs, because this is what people become when they are denied some semblance of dignified life for way too long. Can you even think about possible ways of diffusing this metaphorical explosive divide made of millions of human souls?
Well, I think that the obvious way to diffuse this problem is to create a real Palestinian state, change completely the policies which have been conducting by Israel with the help of the United States. They have been deliberately trying actually to dissolve this problem, by the settlement policy, by the isolation policy, by putting the Palestinian issue beyond the brackets by focusing on Iran, by focusing on the Israeli-Saudi rapprochement over the recent months, you know, and this made this explosion really possible and inevitable. So indeed, you have to create Palestinian statehood and Palestinian state first. Secondly, you have to guarantee its existence from the security perspective, from the economic perspective. You have to, you know, invest into Palestine and bring some, build up some real economy there with the help of neighboring countries. It is in the interest of countries like Jordan, Egypt, and Israel itself, because after all, now we see that the current track does not really guarantee Israeli security. So we have to return to the spirit of Oslo agreements of 1994 and reject basically the policies that have been conducting wrongly afterwards, but unfortunately not but just by Israel, but by the United States as well.
Can I ask you something here? Because one of your colleagues, Fedor Lukyanov, said recently that one of the things that this eruption of violence has demonstrated is that a strategy of biding time and essentially putting a frozen conflict on hold in the hopes of it petering out by itself doesn't seem to work. It seems to be pretty dangerous, and the semblance of control that Israelis may have had has been not just broken, it was broken in a very humiliating and utterly sadistic way. But from what you've been suggesting about Netanyahu's attempt to move all, or to shift all the attention to Iran, it seems like he's still pursuing the same tactic. What can possibly persuade Israel to change its tack? Do you think the Americans want to be taken for a ride here by Israel?
Well, first, of course, you have to compel and convince the Israeli elite and society and Israel as well, you know, to focus on Palestine instead of Iran. It will be difficult, right? Because Israel has indeed convinced itself of Iran, not the Palestinians, being its existential threat and the real danger. How to do it? Well, I think that the world has changed significantly since 1970s and even 1990s. And the major change is the emergence of the world majority as a subject of international affairs, as something that has huge agency in IR. You know, countries like Saudi Arabia and Egypt and Turkey are no longer just the objects of great power confrontation. They are the subjects. They are the actors. And they can create a new reality together with Israel, right? I think it, the international community and the world majority simply needs to convince Israel that it is impossible for Israel to continue, you know, the existing policies as it was. It would not bring security. And the United States is not the kind of the United States that was in 1990s. Actually, building bridges.
Dmitry, let me. I'm sorry for interrupting you all the time, but let me stop you just here because this is a very important question: the role of the Americans in this whole conflagration. Let's address it after a very, very short break. We will be back. Stay tuned.
There's no end in sight over how you're going to continue to destroy the earth.
It's the case of the madness of the people.
I tried to go to the gym, but I'm certainly not ready to fight Russia.
This is all so absurd.
This is third world lunacy. Brainwashing.
As Ursula von der Leyen likes to say, we have the tools.
Why don't we just start with stability and business deals?
You know what? Planet, I've been living on land.
We have very good propaganda in our press here in Europe.
I think we don't know the aftermath.
Anytime that you're not allowed to ask questions, you should ask all of the questions.
The more questions asked, the better the answers will be.
Yeah.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Dmitry Suslov, Deputy Director of the Center for Comprehensive European and International Studies at the Higher School of Economics in Moscow. Dmitry, just before the break, we were talking about the whole new world emerging, the global majority that needs to put pressure on Israel. And of course, it's impossible to have this conversation without mentioning the Americans, who have always assumed the role of a chaperone of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And I wonder, let me repeat the second part of my previous question. That is, do you think the Americans want to be used by Israelis as their big proxy with big guns, with lots of influence? Do you think they want to be utilized in such a way that they usually utilize other countries?
Look, the United States, I think, have put themselves in a very difficult position. First, the Biden administration tries to build bridges with the world majority. I think the Ukraine conflict has showed very explicitly that the global majority is not at the side of the United States. The U.S. is losing global influence, and they try to reverse it by accommodating major countries in the global majority, including Saudi Arabia, which they do not want, you know, further partnership with China. And I think that actually one of the major reasons why the U.S. were promoting this Saudi-Israeli rapprochement is to try to at least limit the Saudi partnership with China. So the United States needs global majority. This is first point. But on the other hand, Israel is a part of American domestic politics, not just of the U.S. foreign policy, but of the American domestic politics. The Israeli question is of huge importance, and thus, you know, it is very difficult for the United States. They try to not to antagonize Israel on the one hand. They can't afford doing that because of their domestic political factors, but they can't afford further antagonization of the global majority at the same time, right? And what does it mean? It means that the United States per se can no longer monopolize the Israeli-Palestinian question. They tried, they fail, they can no longer continue as an effective
Dmitry, broker. Dmitry, let's talk about monopolizing, because I mean, I think this case provides a very important litmus test for leadership. And by leadership, I mean not just rhetorical statements of support or condemnation, but actual difficult, painstaking work of diplomacy, negotiating skills, etc. And it doesn't seem like the United States possesses any of that. I mean, now the situation is actually calling for bold, responsible leadership. And look at the track record of voting in the United Nations Security Council. They don't seem to be able to do anything. And, you know, my question here is actually, isn't this situation demonstrating that the United States, even if it wants to be a leader, I mean, it can be a leader in situations when, you know, its participation is not necessary, but when it is calling for it, they don't seem to possess even the skills of approaching it.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. Biden continues to say that the United States holds the world together. I think the reality is just the contrary. I think that in the Middle East, the regional powers, the global majority or the world majority could have and would have kept the situation together, avoiding escalation, whereas the United States is the reason for destabilization. And now we see just an unquestionable proof of that in the case of the escalation in the Middle East. So indeed, the United States cannot provide the necessary leadership because it is focused on other priorities, because the priorities of the United States is struggling against China and struggling against Russia and keeping the Middle East in a way that it cannot be kind of dominated by China or by Russia. So they view the situation from the perspective of great power competition, not from the perspective of regional security, and also from the perspective of their domestic politics. You know, combined, the United States cannot be a fair and effective mediator. So you have to create the participation of the world majority, comprising of both global actors like Russia, China, maybe Brazil, you know, the BRICS as a whole, and the regional players, of course, including Israel, but also including Iran and the Arab major countries, as an institutionalization of collective leadership. So not American unilateral one, but collective leadership by the world majority, I think is necessary to resolve this crisis now.
Now, let's bring our discussion a little bit closer to home, because for the last two or so years, we've all been following the confrontation in and over Ukraine between Russia and the collective West. And I've heard many analysts, including yourself, say that the next world order, the new composition of the international system, will be based on the outcome of that battle. I wonder if what's happening in the Middle East can change that prediction. Do you see any implications of this latest eruption of violence and the focus of international attention on it for the Ukrainian front?
Well, I think that the Middle Eastern conflict is also a very clear indicator of the failure of the West to build new sustainable international order. Right, the West, the United States, has tried and failed, and now it is impossible to bring sustainable stability into the Middle East.
But it wasn't ever a goal. I mean, we've all been assuming that it's the ultimate goal to create peace and sustainable development. But aren't we too much buying into the American rhetoric? Do they actually want peace?
That's what I'm saying. They don't. The similarity between the Ukraine conflict and the Middle Eastern conflict is that in both cases, the United States is trying to prolong their hegemony instead of building peace, right? And the conflicts themselves are instruments for the United States to continue its hegemonic policies, right? By defeating the adversaries. In the Middle East, they try to weaken and defeat Iran. In Ukraine, they try to weaken and defeat Russia, and so on and so forth. So it's not about stability, it's about American hegemony, right? This is first point. Second point, of course, the escalation in the Middle East is a bad news for Ukraine, because the global and Western media is distracted, political attention is distracted. Just look what's going on in the American Congress, not just in the House of Representatives, but even the Republican senators, who have been traditionally more friendly vis-a-vis Ukraine, are claiming that in the context of the escalation in the Middle East, there is no way for the United States to sustain the previous numbers and intensity of their military support.
Well, this is a critical issue for us to discuss, because I know that a couple of months ago you predicted that the United States would be increasing their military support of the Zelensky government in quantitative and qualitative terms. It seems like you are changing your opinion on that. I mean, is it ultimately sustainable, especially not only in the views of Israel's plans, but within the prospect of a major regional conflict? Sure, the United States may need that weapons, those weapons for itself.
Look, I think that I was absolutely right, because I was making those predictions in the context of the beginning of Ukrainian counteroffensive towards the Sea of Azov, right? It was just in the initial stages. And of course, the West was committed to helping Ukraine in a full-scale way to make this counteroffensive effective. So the West was really increasing its military help to Ukraine quantitatively and qualitatively over the last several months, including, of course, the provision of cluster bombs, of ATACMS, long-range ballistic missiles, the promise to deliver F-16 fighters, and so on and so forth. So it was really the case. But now the situation changed. right? And the major difference why I'm not changing my opinion, the situation changed. A, the Ukrainian counteroffensive failed. Everyone recognizes that. Secondly, Israel is a more vital and imminent priority for the United States. So taken together, of course, the West will reduce the quality and quantity of its help to Ukraine. The Biden administration will not write Ukraine off, but I think we should forget about any prospect of another major Ukrainian counteroffensive next year, at least.
Dmitry, right? Can I ask you something very quick, because we are running out of time, but I think this is a crucial problem. You've been writing all along that one of the major reasons for confrontation with Russia on the Western side is are Western attempts to strip Russia of its great power status. And great power means being able to influence events practically on the ground, diplomatically, economically, sometimes militarily. Do you think there may ever come a point when the United States would not fight those Russian abilities to influence events, but actually try to benefit from them, either in Ukraine or, let's say, in the context of the Middle East? Because Russia does have a lot of capacity for settling disputes in a fair and balanced way.
Well, the idealistic image that you have created requires a fundamental change of the major parameters of the U.S. foreign policy. I do not see that in the making in the observable future. I think that during the next 10, 15, maybe 20 years, the United States will be still obsessed with great power struggle. Struggling Russia and struggling China will be focused on, preservation of American primacy and hegemony in the world, even in the absence of its hegemony. Despite a certain generational change and despite the change of the mood among Republicans and the leftist liberal Democrats, the U.S. foreign policy is still monopolized by the deep state and the traditional establishment, which are committed to the post-Cold War paradigm of the U.S. Global leadership. So much more internal and external crisis, unfortunately, will be required for the United States to reject this policy of confronting Russia. They will continue the hybrid war against Russia and systemic confrontational policies, unfortunately, even after there is a ceasefire or resolution of the conflict in Ukraine. They will continue sanctions. They will continue demonization of Russia. Unfortunately, I do not see any indication of any hint for a change of American foreign policy vis-a-vis Russia towards some improvement in the observable prospect. In the longer term prospect, if and when the United States finally accepts the realities of multipolarity and starts to play a role of one among many, this change would certainly become inevitable.
Well, Dmitry, you painted a very black or rather pessimistic picture. I would use the Israel's recent problems as gory, but to some extent inspiring example, because reality still has its ways of imposing itself onto perceptions. And if that happened to Israel, maybe that will also happen to the United States, although I hope in a less bloody way. We have to leave it there, but it's been a great pleasure, as always, for me to talk to you. Thank you very much for your insights.
Thank you, Oksana. Always a pleasure.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.